Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Welcome to episode 4, where we talk about tapestry and rug weaving. Our guest today is Mary Zikafoos, whose powerfully symbolic tapestries and rugs have appeared in galleries all over the world. Today's swatch will be presented by talented Texas weaver Marnie Harang, and then we'll have an audio essay, Weaving Community. I'd like to welcome new listeners. I've started to mention Weavecast at guild meetings. So if you are an Olympia Guild member or a member of the Seattle Weavers Guild and you're just checking out the show, come on in. We're quite friendly and good to have you here. And I must warn you, I got braces last week. They're taking a little bit of getting used to. If I have a bit of a lisp, please bear with me. I am grateful and humbled by all the wonderful comments I got after the last episode. Last episode ended on a bit of a downer. I talked about not getting a grant I had applied for. And the outpouring that came back was just wonderful. So many of you left a comment on the blog telling me that Weavecast was inspiring. I really appreciated that. I was in a low moment and not sure if the podcast was even worth carrying forward. Your comments made the difference. You really impressed on me that there is, in fact, an audience out there, a growing audience. Last I checked, we had over 100 subscribers, and I know from the downloads that more of you are downloading without subscribing. The podcast is still only a couple of months old, so this is amazing that it has grown this fast. What was really interesting is that about 60% of the people who sent in comments are not weavers. They were typically knitters, some spinners, or just curious about weaving. And many, many of them said, Weavecast has inspired me, and now I want to weave. And that is very exciting. So thank you for those comments, and I really appreciate all of the support. And speaking of support, one listener, Diane, took it a step further. She said, give me a way to donate because I would like to help support the server fees and all the other costs involved with putting up Weavecast. And I have added some navigation links to the top of the page, and one of them links to a PayPal donation button. Bless her heart, she is our first Weavecast pledge, and it was a much larger amount than I would have expected. I was expecting something on the order of a latte, and it was more than that. Diane, thank you. Other navigation links are a help/frequently asked questions page. You can go there to get help with technical problems, or if you have a question such as, may I play Weavecast for my guild? And the answer is, of course you may. Questions like that are answered on the FAQ. I have a submission guidelines page. If you have a story about how weaving has changed your life, or a story about a particularly interesting swatch you've woven, please do send those in. I'd like to hear your voice on the air. The last link is a bit of an experiment. I've created a Weavecast store, and it's not the ubiquitous cafe press, get your logo on a t-shirt kind of store. It is a place where you can buy episodes of Weavecast archived on audio CDs. Now, you might say, why when I can get it for free off the internet? I've been thinking about my audience. Some people do not have the ability to download 50 megabyte files. I'm becoming more and more aware of that. My mother, bless her heart, loves listening to Weavecast, but she has a dial-up connection, and it is just too painful and slow, and sometimes she can't maintain the connection long enough to get the entire 50 megabytes. So, because she's my mom, I send her a CD every month for free. But I thought there might be other people who would like the option of buying it on CD. If you want to, you may. If you don't want to, that's fine. If you want to support Weavecast financially, this is not the way to do it. I'm keeping costs bare bones on these CDs because they're just a way to get Weavecast to a wider audience. If you want to support Weavecast financially, please pledge a donation instead. I have got a lot of great news this episode. I think of last episode as the downer episode, but this is the happy episode. Some really great things have happened recently. I have been booked for a gig for the Whidbey Island Weavers Guild in February 2007. They want me to talk about Weavecast and all the adventures I've had putting together the show and garnering interviews. And I'm very excited. I'm passionate about weaving, and I'm passionate about this podcast and podcasting in general and internet technologies and ways of building communities outside of geographical borders. There are a lot of people who cannot get to a guild or cannot find other people interested in weaving in their area. But through the internet, through blogs, through podcasts, they can find community. That's what I'm going to talk about in February. This past weekend, I attended a velvet weaving workshop. Yes, velvet weaving. Is that cool or what? It will be the subject of a future Weavecast episode. I've talked to the instructor, Jan Paul, and she has graciously agreed to be interviewed. And she has studied how to weave fine velvet brocades with master weavers in Italy. So when she speaks of velvet, she knows whereof she speaks. Next up, we have an interview with Mary Zikafuz. I'm going to play you in with a song called Wake the Dragon by Dragon Ritual Drummers. And I chose this song because it evoked in me the same feeling I got when I looked at her bold graphical tapestries. So let's listen to a little bit of this to set the mood. Here I am with Mary Zikafuz, who is a fabulous rug and tapestry weaver working with strong symbolic images. Her work has appeared in the United States Embassy offices on three continents and in corporate offices all over the world. I'm very glad and grateful that she was willing to come on the show.
Good morning.
What brought you to hand weaving?
I was just talking with someone about this a couple nights ago, and I changed my story, which was interesting. I always have this canned story of how I started weaving, and I was surprised what came out of my mouth when we were having dinner. And the story that I told the other night was that when I was in high school in Niles, Michigan, I worked my high school job in a bookstore, in an old Victorian bookstore, and there was what you would call an old maid woman who ran the bookstore. And it was a lovely place. This was the 60s. She was a weaver, and throughout the bookstore, she had all kinds of looms set up and was always working on something. And there was, as we all know, this incredible energy that exuded not only from the looms, but from the pieces she was working on. But what captured me most about the years that I was there were the people that came in, was her community. The community of women that were weavers. They had an absolute blast. They were constantly planning trips, going places, planning projects, working on things. And at that particular time in our culture and in the woman's awakening on the planet, it was shocking because my mother and her friends were not getting down like these gals were. You know, they were living a different reality, and these women were so high on life and personal growth and and what they were creating, that I think really is what awakened me to in essence, the power of cloth.
I know what you mean. I go to the local Weavers Guild and I interact with all these amazing women who are each one of them doing exciting work, and they're so passionate about what they're doing that I always come away with this buzz that carries me through the next few days.
Very inspiring.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time, maybe I was a senior in high school, her name was Maxine Showers. Maxine had a little table loom and she lent it to me. She goes, "Here, Mary, why don't you take this and, you know, do some weaving?" Well, great idea. I didn't have a clue. So I took the loom, you know, dutifully, and it sat in my bedroom on the floor for like 2 years. I did nothing with it. I gave it back to her kind of quietly, and she said, "Well, how did, you know, I haven't seen what you made." I said, "I didn't make anything. You know, I don't know how to weave. You know, you forgot that critical ingredient." And off I went to college, and it was my senior year in college. I was doing a portfolio review with the head of the art department, and I was showing her all my work, and she kind of stopped and looked at me, and she goes, said, "Mary, These are all rug designs. These are all textile patterns."
Interesting.
Which I was devastated, you know. I wanted her to say, "My God, you know, you're the next hot painter coming down the pike." And I was incredulous. I remember the moment. It was almost like she had slapped me. I said, "What? Textile design? Rug designs? Who makes rugs?" And in my college, there was not a weaving program. So it pretty much shocked me, and I discarded the words immediately. I never said a word to anyone. Off I went in my life, and then I was in graduate school working on an MFA in clay, and I changed programs from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago to the University of Nebraska. Was very unhappy with my new program, and coincidentally had a studio next to a weaver in residence, and would just go in there and, you know, goggle at all the equipment daily, particularly the warping board. I couldn't imagine what the heck you did with a warping board, you know. So anyway, one day she set her loom up, she said, "Mary, just sit down and weave." And I wove a little red mohair scarf, and I got up from the loom that day, and that was it.
You were a weaver.
I was a weaver.
Very cool. Very cool. So what, aside from your advisor telling you that you were already doing rug designs, what caused you to end up specializing in tapestry and rugs?
I think it's kind of a visual predilection. That's where I gravitate. I wove the red mohair scarf, but as I was weaving it, what I was envisioning were large, huge graphic pieces, very painterly, kind of iconic pieces, not sculptural in nature, but large and very graphic. And that's been my bent from the very get-go. I very much am drawn to flat pattern, large saturated fields of color, interplay between minimal elements, but big interplay between color. And so from the mohair scarf, I had quite a few years of a learning curve to master. My visual vocabulary and visions were quite sophisticated. My technical ability was about 2 or 3 year old level.
Well, I've seen your works, and since you've come to the Seattle Weavers Guild, I got to see one of them up close, and they're very visually impactful. You look at them and you just go, wow. I invite the people listening to this to go check out your gallery on your website, which is at www.maryzikafoos.com, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. But what I notice is you have these strong graphical images, you have these powerful colors, but you also use a lot of symbolism and iconic images. How did you get into using symbolism?
You know, I've got to give the Catholic Church full credit for that. I was raised a good Catholic girl. I, from the get-go, was drawn to all of the stuff that organized religion, particularly Catholicism, embraces, like the paraphernalia. And it wasn't so much the essence of the Catholic faith that caught me, it was the junk that was associated with it, you know?
You were drawn
the
to
incense
ritual?
Things, the ritual, the robes. I'll tell you a little story that I think kind of says it all. When I was in grade school, I was an altar care girl, which was quite a coveted job. And I was the head altar care girl, which meant during my recess, I would give up my recess and go to the church and lay out the vestments for the priests the next day. An old nun showed us how to do this, and it was quite a thing about you, the way you laid them out, what color symbolized this and that, and I loved it. I'd walk into that place and just get high on the smell of the incense, touching the robes. Loved it. And I had a great friend, Cindy Thornton. We would lay out these vestments, and one day as we were laying them out, I got a wonderful idea to take the stole for the sacrament of penance and go out to the playground and go behind the lilac bush, put it on, and hear confessions of my fellow classmates. And I went out, put the thing on, went behind the bush, and there was a line in a minute. I mean, everybody got it. That was the stole for confession. So I heard confessions, and I was quite good at it, if I must say so. No one said a word. I mean, we came back in. I went to school the next day. Not a word. So I got pretty confident that I was not only good at this, but as soon as I put that stole on, I could sense the power of the cloth. And I knew everybody else sensed the power of the cloth. So a couple days later, to make a long story short, Cindy and I went back into church. I put on all the vestments for, Advent or something. She put on all the vestments for Easter. We strapped on our roller skates and headed down the main aisle. And it was probably one of the higher moments of my life. I mean, the smell, the feel of the silk, the rush of the power. And as we're sweeping down the aisle with these vestments, trailing behind us, we crashed right away into Father Rose, the pastor of the parish. I was demoted in shame. My mother still talks about it. Her friends still, cluck when they see me.
Well, so what an interesting anecdote to represent how what we wear influences how we feel about ourselves. And you were talking about the power imbued in the cloth, because everybody recognized it as a symbol.
Getting back more directly to your question about symbolism in my work, what always caught me was the symbolism of color, and that how a whole planet of people, of Catholics, for instance, believe that green meant this and yellow meant that. That caught me so in such a way. And also all of those Catholic symbols. And in my life, I have moved on from that particular dogma and belief. But symbols have always really revealed themselves to me. And every time I have followed my intuition, and seen a symbol and gone, what if? Or I think that I should do this or that. It has always led me in the right direction. They are very big intuitive clues for me. And it's worked, fantastically in my work. I mean, that's what leads me through my weaving, is the use of symbol.
Can you tell us a little bit about your inspirations and how you plan a piece?
The first thing I do, and this is quite literally and quite truly, everything before I begin a series of pieces, and every year I do an annual group of pieces, always at least 13, that are all completely new designs. But before I begin this, it's quite a meditative thing for me. I get very quiet. I spend either an hour or hours or days in a meditating and being very introspective. And the questions that I ask are, what do I need to be doing? What does the planet need to be receiving from me at this time? What is my assignment? Sometimes I get it instantly. Sometimes it takes a little longer. But I feel that this world is, we've got so much stuff in it already. I don't want to be contributing by adding more piles of meaningless stuff. There has to be a reason for these pieces to be born. Mm-hmm. And there has to be a reason for me to spend the 2,000 hours making them. Right. There's got to be quite a strong connection. And until I get that connection, I don't do anything.
So are you actually sitting in a quiet place meditating?
Yeah.
Really?
I do. Wow. Sometimes it's in my studio, but I actually take, the time off. And I'm a lifelong meditator, so it's a process that's very well honed for me.
Well, I think what's interesting about that is I've talked to several prominent weavers doing this podcast, and a common theme seems to be it's the work has to be important to them before it can be important to other people. They take it very seriously, and I admire the deliberateness with which you come to your work.
The flip side of that is I struggle with commissions, because oftentimes they're not important. They're a wonderful ticket for this and that, but if I don't have a deep connection to it, it's really difficult for me to, I have to like chain myself to the loom to follow through on them. But anyway, once this kind of beams, you know, I always call it beaming down or downloading, once I get the download on what I need to do, I start sketching, and I do just hundreds and hundreds of little teeny drawings, little teeny tapestries, little teeny rugs, and those are a joy. I mean, they come effortlessly. I just draw. From there, I lay everything out, and obviously the strong pieces, kind of the group emerges. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like American Idol, you know. You start with, like, you know, the 10,000, and then you end up with the final 12. And it's about as ridiculous on some levels.
I have this image of you now talking to this little piece of paper going, wow, that really stinks. You're out of here.
It's, you know, it's pretty similar, the whole process. And there's some that are absolutely adorable, but, you know, they're just not, it's not time for you yet.
Right.
You need more work.
Right.
And so once I get my little drawings, then I render them in color. And I used to use color pencils, and I was just color. And now I use silk screen papers called Color Aid papers, and you can purchase them at most art supply stores. You get them in packs of, I think, 380 colors. They're fabulous. They're gorgeous. They're saturated. And I cut and paste. Mm-hmm. And many weavers could never think of doing something like that because they don't work so simply.
Right.
But because I'm working with really simple archetypal symbols and shapes and big fields of color, I can easily recreate my pieces. So I do all this cutting and pasting. Then we go through another round and we look at everything. And the pieces, the strong pieces emerge. And then I take these little color mock-ups to Kinko's and I blow them up exactly the size of the finished piece. And it's not a color rendering, but it's a black and white. And there I can see if that symbol is going to look fabulous, 5 feet by 7 feet, or if it's going to look absolutely, you know, or if it loses its power.
Scale changes so much. I think that's
scale
brilliant.
Scale is everything. And I love work. I mean, I love scale. I think that color and scale, they're it, really. And then once those pieces emerge, then everything goes into gridded down on graph paper to a working model. And then the looms get warped and away we go.
I learned so much listening to you talk about the deliberateness of each step, how you're constantly weeding out designs that could be better. I think that's a great way to work. I notice in your work that you use very vivid colors, but you limit yourself to a palette of 4 or less. How did you make that decision?
Initially, the decision was made by working just with those colors that I loved, that I gravitated toward, which was pretty much the primary palette. And I think I'm pretty much still discovering the wonders of the primary palette. For one, those colors resonate beautifully together. They sing and dance in and around themselves. And they resonate much like the musical instruments in, for instance, a string quartet. In the world of music, for centuries, we've been listening to trios and quartets where there's only 3 or 4 voices, the violin, the viola, and the cello, and then there's a first and second violin. And that combination creates the most sublime music in the world. And in listening to that, not initially, but over the years, I realized that the same holds true with color. When you limit your palette to 3 voices, you can create some incredible harmonies as well as, you know, ecstatic moments. I seem to work very well in that kind of a range.
I noticed that you do a lot of your own dyeing, or perhaps all
of it. Yeah, I do all my own dyeing.
I know that's a lot of extra work. What is it about the hand-dyed yarns that make it worth all that extra time and trouble?
I could not create what I just spoke of, the ecstasies, the harmonies of voices, unless I did my own dyeing. When I first started weaving, I bought any kind of wool, any kind of yarn, in fact, that I could get on sale for literally nothing. I would go into my kitchen, I bought Cushing dyes, which is Cushing is a mill dye. It's like one step up from Rit dye. You know, it's not state of the art color.
Right.
And I would, you know, mix up my Cushing dye, throw in the yarn, and I over dyed everything that I could get my hands on, and I just wove, and everything kind of looked Amish. I was into this sort of. What color? I think it was it mulberry, Cushing mulberry. I don't know what number it was, but I call it my Amish phase because we have all of photos of all these pieces that are so heavy and so somber. I evolved out of that, thank goodness. For one, the colors were fading. I knew it wasn't the quality that I wanted. We spent some time in South America and just being in a year in that culture with people doing handwork and in a culture that was so vibrant with color, I came home and I couldn't face the mulberry anymore. So I started using pro washfast acid dyes, which just dye wool in an incredible way. And that was it. Once I started dyeing, I remember on one of my first pieces, I ran out of some black. And I went, well, not a deal. I'll just run down to the weaving shop and pick up some black. Well, I was holding my little skein, ran down to the weaving shop, and everything on the shelf compared to what I had was inert. You know, it was lifeless. And that was when I realized, you know, really the power of what I was doing, that I was creating a color that had a vitality that I couldn't buy. And so since then, I probably have formulated over 1,000 dye recipes over the years. My recipe, for instance, for Simple Black has 3 colorants in it. It has black, navy blue, and a percentage of orange.
Oh, interesting. I would have never guessed.
And
orange.
So you get all of these layers. You know, you get layers and you can create depth, you can create subtlety. And because my pieces are so minimal in shape and form, much of the dialogue and much of the story is about the subtlety of color. That it may be a color that has a tremendous pop to it, but you fall into it because there's layer upon layer. And maybe there was 30 yellows that were woven together to make that yellow background,
yeah,
or 30 shades of yellow.
I noticed that about the piece that I got to look at up close. When you see the images on the web, they're visually impactful and pow, but when you get to hold the actual piece, the color is very textured.
Yeah.
You have a yellow background, but like you said, there are 20 different colors of yellow in there, and they kind of gradiate, and it does add a lot of richness to it. So, and you make me want to go to my dye pot and start playing.
And I love to dye. It's one of my favorite parts.
Yeah, there's something kind of magically transformative about pulling the yarn out of the dye pot and seeing its color change. On your website, I was really taken by a series of prayer blankets you've mm-hmm. done, especially the zebra patterned one. And I was wondering, what was the inspiration or theme behind those prayer blankets?
For me, the naming of pieces is probably equally significant as the creation of the piece. I feel that the name carries the vibration of the piece and really anchors it. The prayer blanket series, you know, what was the inspiration? I just got it. I mean, I was weaving one day and I understood. I mean, the piece told me, okay, I am a prayer blanket and there's a lot more coming. Kind of that was the message I got, and it was so exciting when I got that. And so a series of pieces called prayer blankets emerged that all had what I felt kind of a planetary story. And I don't want to sound too woo-woo-y because I don't think I am real woo-woo-y, but the first one was prayer blanket for the solar eclipse. And I had gone to Hawaii for the solar eclipse. And I had been invited, actually, by the Levi Strauss family invited me there when we were working in Bolivia. The Strausses came down as potential donors to a project we were working on. And they invited us to come to Hawaii to a party they were having for the solar eclipse. So I went to Hawaii. And the solar eclipse was pretty cool. You know, it really rocked my boat.
Uh-huh.
And I came home and wove a piece about it. I started, the prayer blankets all were sort of had a planetary celestial mission about them. The piece you referred to, Prayer Blanket for Vanishing a Species, was probably my only environmental political statement I've ever made with weaving, and it was the piece replicates the skin of a zebra, and it's done through weft-faced ikat. When I wove the piece, it really was a strong statement for me about endangered species. We had worked in Bolivia and working with endangered species, and I felt that I had kind of put my little pin on the map saying, this is where I stand.
I love that title because it's so intriguing. It's not prayer blanket for a vanishing species. It's prayer blanket for vanishing a species. And ever since I read that on your website, it's just been rattling around my head, and I keep going, what does that mean? What does that mean?
You know, what does that mean? I'll jump in a little more because everyone always corrects it and puts prayer blanket, you know, whenever it was printed, and it's an image that's been printed a lot. And actually, as I was weaving the piece, what I was dealing with was that not only are species being eliminated, but I think species have a shelf life, and that sometimes the elimination goes part and parcel with their agreement that it's time for them, that their purpose, they're done. Mm-hmm. They came, they were perfect for this time and this assignment, and now it's over. And so we can try to keep that species going, but it's kind of the Native American Indian thing. I mean, there have been cultures on the planet that they've absolutely reached the summit and pinnacle of all the highest energies, and then they've died away. And I don't think that's accidental, nor do I think that they died away out of cruelty. I think it was time to go. And so when I was dealing with issues like that, is it time for these animals to go? Mm-hmm. How are they assisting in leaving and, you know, stuff like that.
Very interesting. Very cool. So what's next for you? What's inspiring you currently?
The body of work that I'm working on right now is based on the symbol of the sun as an archetypal symbol. And I'm saying sun rather than circle because I think the two, they both occupy the same kind of shape, but they have completely two different bodies of energy to them. So the name of the group is Sun Signs, and the show is going to open and be seen first in Omaha, Nebraska, where I live, mm-hmm. at a wonderful new space. The Nebraska Arts Council has a wonderful exhibition space in downtown Omaha, and they've just started featuring shows there. So I will be there. I think the show goes up May 17th, and it will be there for a couple of months. And then it will move on, part of it will move on to Montana, to Bozeman, Montana, to the Montana Association of Weavers and Spinners. They're having a conference, and I'll be speaking there and teaching at that conference. And so I'll have a show in conjunction with that. And then we'll see where it goes from there.
Wonderful. Well, yeah. if people listening want to check out this show or any of Mary Zikafusa's wonderful workshops that she offers, please go reference her website and take a look on there. Well, Mary, I have to say it's been wonderful having you on the show. I really appreciate you sharing your techniques and your inspirations. And so thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a delight being in the Northwest. I always love to come up and visit. And I just hope that your endeavor sign just flies. I think it's a great contribution you're making.
Well, thank you. It's been very rewarding. Wasn't she great? I just had a blast talking with Mary Zikafusa. She was very approachable and very inspiring, and I'm grateful that she came on the show. If you haven't seen her work, please go to the show notes at www.weavecast.com, and I will have a link to her gallery. Really impressive stuff. Next up, we have Marnie Harang, and she's going to talk to us about warping a Navajo loom. To get us in the mood, I'm going to play Birds and Bugs by Lunar Drive from their album Here at Black Mesa. And this is the perfect music to transition from Mary Zikafusa to Marnie Harang, because it also deals with that theme of things going away and ecological situations.
Humans, and then we kind of came up last. So sometimes I think about animals that are extinct, they're just going on to another world, and it's those stupid humans that will be emerging out last again. All the life that we managed to get rid of by our pollution and our greed, they just move to the next world, then we just come along again.
Next up, we have an audio essay submitted by Marnie Harang. Actually, she didn't realize she was submitting me an essay at the time. This started as a series of emails in which she said she really empathized with the first Fear of Warping episode, and that trying to warp a multi-shaft loom was so hard for her that it actually drove her back to Navajo weaving. And I couldn't let that go. I had to know the rest of the story. Over a series of emails, we discussed what had happened, and she told this wonderfully evocative and interesting and fun story. I begged her to let me share it on the show, and she graciously agreed. I'll be doing the reading because we weren't able to get the audio thing worked out. But I hope that you enjoyed as much as I did, and I hope it inspires you to think about possibly submitting something to the show. We all have wonderful stories to tell, and I'd love to hear yours. Fear of Warping 2, Return to Navajo Weaving by Marnie Harang. For Christmas, my husband bought me a table loom. With much love and enthusiasm, he spent hours refurbishing it. Then he offered to help me warp it. Several days, after much cursing and despairing, we got the thing warped. I could not weave something on it after so much time, so I played around with Nancy Harvey's tapestry techniques and finishing from a book called Finishing Touches for the Hand Weaver by Virginia West. The results were not totally displeasing, but because they had no good associations, they ended up in the depths of a box somewhere in the house. All of the tension and frustration of this experience with warping reminded me of the peaceful, soothing Navajo weaving I had done as a child. I rediscovered the techniques I had learned from our ranch foreman's wife when I took a beginning Navajo weaving workshop from Belle Rosing at the Taos Wool Festival. I am convinced that should I die and go to hell, I will spend eternity warping and weaving on a multi-shaft loom, and I tell my husband so frequently. To this day, he insists I should learn to weave on a multi-shaft loom, as he doesn't consider my Navajo loom, a simple frame, a real loom. Navajo warping. Warping on a Navajo loom is a four-step process, which, although involved and sometimes exhausting, is more of a spiritual relaxation than warping a multi-shaft loom. The primary difference is in Navajo weaving, you deal with a single continuous thread, which is warped onto the beam sticks as I measure it out. Like the solitary warp thread, I do the work alone. The first step is to create the warp. This involves manipulating the ball of warp over and under the beam sticks in the proper sequence to ensure a good cross. The only difficulty is maintaining an even tension. There is a soothing right-hand, left-hand rhythm to it, which is part of the ritual of bowing and bending to the four directions. Once I start, I dare not stop. So I make sure that I am sufficiently hydrated, have taken the phone off the hook, shut out the cats, and chanted an appropriate prayer or song so that I will be able to go on with warping as long as it takes to get from the start to the finish. Depending on size and density of the warp, this can be as short as 30 minutes or as long as 4 to 6 hours. Once the warp is run, spaced, and tied off, I stop, heave a sigh, chant the Skyloom song, light a candle, have a cup of tea, take a break. Then I fondle and contemplate my weaving bowls and begin thinking of a design. The second step of the cycle is to tie the twisted cording to the warp and tie the corded warp onto the beams. Again, consistent tension is crucial, as is consistent spacing. I do not stop once I start. A twisted cord is braided between each warp pair to set the spacing. I cord both ends of the warp, one at a time, checking my spacing and tension as I go. Once the cording is complete, I put in temporary shed sticks. I tie or tape their ends together so they won't slip out of the warp. Then comes the scariest moment, when I remove the temporary beams, which, to this point, have been holding the warp straight and aligned, and then I prepare to mount the resulting twisted mass onto my permanent beams. The second phase of the cording is to lash both ends of the corded warp onto the permanent loom beams. Again, the spacing is done by hand, and the cord must be tightly lashed to the loom's beam. If my hands are not too sore or blistered from pulling and tying the cording at this point, I will complete and tie another warp, since it is easier to do several at one time. I wrap the extra warps around shed sticks and store them for future use. Then I take another break to chant, drink tea, stretch, and assure the kitties that I am still alive and well. Then the third step begins. This is setting the sheds and creating the string heddles. The warp, which is now lashed to the loom beams, is tied onto the loom under light tension. In Navajo weaving, there is one stick shed and 1 to 3 additional sheds created by string heddles. Once a shed stick has been inserted into the warp, a weaving batten is carefully fed through the warp below to pick up the threads for the first heddle. A ball of heddle string is looped around each lifted warp and lashed onto the heddle stick. This process is repeated for each additional heddle shed. The fourth and final step is the tensioning of the warp on the loom. This is a matter of brute strength. The beams must be evenly aligned and pulled and tugged until the top and bottom beams, earth and sky, are parallel, and then they are re-secured to the frame under a full tension, which is tight enough that the warp sings when stroked or resounds like a drum when struck with the flat of my hand. Because I weave the traditional way, I always stop at this moment and chant the sky loom song and think about what I want to weave. I thank the warp for not breaking, the cords for being strong enough to hold the warp in place, the heddles for separating the warp threads so nicely, and the loom for remaining upright and strong against the pull of the warp. I start with a design idea, but what comes off the loom may be very different. While I am warping and weaving, I feel where the design wants to go and what the piece wants to be. I try to honor the spirit of the weaving by using my skills to the best of my ability. Isn't that beautiful? I think we should all try to honor the spirit of the work we do by using our skills to the best of our ability. Next up is an essay I wrote called Weaving Community. As I mentioned earlier, I am feeling very blessed and humbled and grateful to know that so many of you out there find my work worthwhile, and I do it to the best of my ability. I'm still on the learning curve to audio perfection. I appreciate that you're enjoying the journey with me as I try to improve the stories and the songs and the quality.
Yeah.
That was You Gotta Know Who Your Friends Are by Blue Number 9 from their album On a Shoestring. And I send that out for all the wonderful friends I've made in the weaving and fiber community. Next up, an audio essay I call Weaving Community. And I've said it before, but it bears repeating. I feel lucky and blessed to have such a great audience and to see this community that's growing around the podcast. And I just want to help it flourish and go forth into the world. I felt for a long time that the people who are involved in fiber-related activities tend to be good-hearted people. And I'm not sure if they are that way and that draws them to knitting and spinning and weaving, or if the very acts of knitting and spinning and weaving turn you into good people. I'm not sure which drives which. I know that Gandhi used to require all his cabinet ministers to spin for an hour a day, which is a political act because the Indian government was trying to become independent of the British, and part of the way to do that was to produce their own hand-spun cloth and become independent of the English mills. But I can't help thinking that the meditative process of spinning and the satisfaction of creating something with your hands didn't make his cabinet ministers better people. I was talking to Judith McKenzie sometime last year and brought this up. I'm like, why is it that whenever I go to a fiber conference, even if I know nobody there, in like 15 minutes, I have 6 new best friends? And I'll be blunt here. I am a somewhat shy person. I do not mix well with strangers. Once I know you, I am the most outgoing person you'll ever know. But until I get over that initial wondering if people are going to get my sense of humor and if I'm going to fit in, I can be a little shy. But I don't run into that when I'm among fiber people. And I said, Judith, why is this? And she said, it's because weaving and spinning and knitting are not necessary. They are things we do because we're passionate about them. And they're also quite rare. If you look at the general populace, many more people watch television or watch sporting events than create things with fiber. Because we're so very passionate about this pursuit, and because this pursuit is somewhat rare, when we get around people who understand and who speak our fiber language, we have an instant connection. I'm so grateful to be a part of that. I think it's a very cool thing. But I can't stop thinking about who we are as fiber artists. Women comprise most of the modern fiber community. As spinning and knitting and weaving became mechanized, the handwork was passed off to the women. The weavers' guilds back in the 1800s were all men, except for a few women who had gotten in because their husbands died and they needed to support the family. These days, the weavers' guilds are 98% to 99% women. And we cherish our male members, don't get us wrong. At the Seattle Weavers Guild, we have a guy who is constantly bringing in fabulous work, and it's just such a joy to see his immense productivity and creativity. But largely, it's a community of women, which makes it very collaborative. And I'm going to speak in generalities for a moment. You're going to have to bear with me. I know that there are women who go against the grain and do not fit into the stereotypically female mold. I have often been one in my life, but when you get a bunch of women together, some feminine traits emerge. They are largely collaborative. They work together. I've noticed a tendency of even the most talented weavers to be somewhat self-effacing. They're producing amazing works. I mean, they might be replicating brocaded velvets with gold bullion in a technique that hasn't been done since the 15th century. And although you can tell they're really proud of the work they've done, if you poke them with a stick, they'll go, oh, yes, well, you know, I did that. And they'll smile, but they won't brag on and on and on about it like they have the right to. And I kind of wish they would. I've also noticed a pack mentality, which is the dark side of being collaborative, in that if one person starts to stand out because they're really good at what they do, there can be some good-natured ribbing that goes on until they become more self-effacing and fall in line. And I don't know if that's an inherently female trait or if that's something that's been imposed on us by society, but I'd like to suggest we go against the grain on this one. I had a very influential belly dance teacher. Her name is Fran Moss, and she goes by the dance name Aramid. I was taking a belly dance class. Perhaps too much information about me, but it's true. She changed my life in this way. I grew up in the Deep South in Jackson, Mississippi. The women in the South are taught to be very competitive with other women. Nice about it. We'd smile to your face, but as soon as your back was turned, whoa, watch out. And so I had all these issues in my head when I was in dance class that I wanted to be the best and the brightest dancer out there. And so I would kind of look sideways at what the other people were doing and silently rank myself against them. I used to do this in aerobics class too. It was terrible. You know, if somebody was doing higher leg lifts than me, I'd get upset and pull a muscle trying to match them. But what this dance instructor taught me was to celebrate the beauty of all the women in the room, regardless of size, shape, age, cesarean scars. She greeted every single one of us as her beautiful dancers. And because she convinced us that's what we were, we danced beautifully. And the type of dance we did was a collaborative dance. So when one of us succeeded, it brought the others up. And I learned to work together as a team, celebrating the triumphs of others. When somebody would bust a beautiful move, we would zagarit, which is a Middle Eastern way of cheering. And I'd like to bring more of that over into the fiber world. If you see somebody weaving something beautiful, it doesn't mean your work is less good. It means that hand weaving as an art form has been elevated. And that person can teach you. And there are going to be things that you do better than that wonderful weaver. You have different strengths and different weaknesses, and perhaps you're less experienced. But I think we should celebrate each other's triumphs more. And so, in this spirit, I would like to shout out a You Go Girl to the person who won the Seattle Weavers Guild grant, the one that I did not win. I am sure that her proposal was wonderful, and I hope her work is tremendously successful and inspires others. Because that's what it's all about. It's about doing good work. As Marnie said, honoring the spirit of the work, whatever your discipline, by doing the best you possibly can. And again, I would like to thank the wonderful community of weavers and listeners who have come out in support of Weavecast. I thank you all. Next episode, we'll have Jennifer Moore of Double Weave fame, and she has woven my favorite piece to date, and we'll get to talk about that. I'll describe a swatch woven double width. This means if your loom is only 26 inches wide, you can weave something 52 inches wide on it by weaving a folded piece of cloth. We'll go over the details for that, and I'll have a WIF file that has all the treadling and tie-up and threading details. We have lots of great episodes on the horizon, including talking about velvet weaving in Italy, secret messages in weaving, and much, much more, so please stay tuned. I'm going to play you out with Along the Navajo Trail by Strand Gold. If you listen to the April 1st Weavecast, you know that this is a group composed of weavers who sing and play musical instruments. Along the Navajo Trail is from their album Many Moons. I'll have a link to them on the show notes, so please check them out.
Every day, along about evening, when the sunlight's beginning to fail, I ride through the slumbering shadows along the Navajo Trail. When it's night and crickets are calling and coyotes making a wail, I dream by a smoldering fire along the Navajo Trail. I love to lie and listen to the music when the wind is strumming a sagebrush guitar. When over star. Well, what do you know? It's morning already. There's the dawning, so silver and pale. It's time to climb into the saddle and ride the Navajo Trail.
Is brought to you by the generosity of our listeners. This episode's sponsor is Diane. Until next episode, this is Sign Mitchell of Weavecast. It's time to get warped, because you have to be warped to weave.